From Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature, real stories about where humans and our habitat meet. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're about to hear three stories about human experiences in nature. We'll start with an outdoor leadership training that quickly became a real-life scenario.
We really had no idea what we were going to find, if we were going to find anything. And it was really scary.
Several years ago, Greg Lay was on an outdoor leadership course high in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado.
Really big mountains, beautiful little valleys that are full of like aspen and willows and things like that. And then higher up, it's lots of stark rocky mountains, snow up there, lots of snow, even though it's May.
The group, about 10 students and two trainers, had been deep in the backcountry for a few days. And then Greg says the weather became
uncertain. The weather was questionable. And then that day it started to get incredible. Some of the windiest conditions I've ever been in.
And that wind sets Greg's story in motion.
We had had dinner as a team, and everything was already set up in our camp. And a group of people decided to go up trail just to check out this lake that was above where we were camped, not too far away, maybe a quarter mile, half a mile away. And just to put the picture in your mind, this is an alpine lake. We're at maybe 9 or 10,000 feet in the Colorado Mountains. It is early summer, but at night it gets very, very cold. And a few minutes later, somebody came back saying, "We need you to bring the first aid kit gear, we need you to bring your tarps, sleeping bags, anything dry that you have, because we found somebody." So we immediately got what we could and rushed up there. And we had encountered this woman, and she had fallen in this lake, very clearly hypothermic, the range where if she didn't get help, she would have been in a really bad way.
Can you maybe describe what she looked like when you first saw her?
It's funny because I don't remember her typical physical attributes, the way, you know, what her hair color was or anything like that. But I remember this look of fear and sadness and hopelessness. I don't think she expected to see anybody. The scariest part and the worst part about it is that she needed help, but her partner needed help much more. She told us that she had been canoeing in this lake. She's actually a canoe instructor, I believe. And she'd been out there with her partner. The wind had capsized their canoe, and they both fell out. So she was able to swim to shore. And she told us that the last time she saw him was when he was clinging to that canoe in the lake. So we had to initiate a search for him. We really had no idea what we were going to find, if we were going to find anything. And it was really scary. In those kinds of situations, there's this system called the incident command system. So it's a common emergency response method. And one of the trainers became an incident commander. We initiated a hasty search. So you can imagine it's getting dark at this point, getting difficult to see. And we wandered around the lake. And eventually we had to recognize that search and rescue had been called. We had a phone that was able to contact search and rescue. And there wasn't really anything more we could do other than set up camp and try to sleep next to the lake. Many of us, I don't think, slept maybe at all. A combination of the fact that we were sleeping next to a lake where we knew that someone was probably dead inside, and the insane winds, really, really intense. And a couple of the the trainees spent the night with this woman. And it's very emotionally draining trying to talk to this person and say, we're doing what we can for you. Search and rescue is on its way, but we can't find him. In the morning, I sat down next to her on this rock overlooking the lake. And that was the only time that I remember her really talking. She didn't say very much, but she said that she doesn't know how she's gonna get over this. Like, she recognized that she had to leave at some point, that she would have to go. And, you know, she's sitting looking at the lake at this point. And she didn't know how she was supposed to leave knowing that he was still in there. It was, I think she didn't know what to say. I think she didn't know what to do. We did a slightly more thorough search with lower expectations than the first time. It's hard to imagine how he could have survived overnight if we hadn't been able to find him. There was some piece of us that was like, that, okay, maybe there's another group out here. Maybe somebody else found him. Maybe he's sitting at a camp somewhere being taken care of. And, you know, we went out at the lake, and you've never really used an ice axe in all of its possible ways until you've strapped one onto a trekking pole so that you can sort of scoop underneath the overhangs into the lake to see if you can catch something, you know.
So what was going through your mind when all of that was happening, when you were doing that?
There were a few things. On one hand, there's these feelings that, and these thoughts that I really hope that I can find something. Anything that would indicate that we've got a lead on where this guy is. I desperately want to find something, so it's very thorough. And then at the same time, there's this part of you that's thinking the whole time, I don't want to find a body in this lake. That would be horrible. But you do it anyway. We would find something and suddenly get very excited and hopeful. We found bits and pieces of things, except that most of the time those were our things, like a sleeping pad that had blown away or somebody's hat that had blown away in the night. And of course, we never did find him. We eventually had to move on. So there was nothing more that we could do. Search and rescue was there. They took over the medical care for this woman. We thought to ourselves, we could just stay here. Like, we could continue this search. We could keep going and maybe find something. And it would be really important to this person if we did, to this woman, if we could do that. And what else can we do? And we were told, but also recognized, that there's nothing else that we can do at this point. And walking away felt so, we felt guilty because it's those like could have or would have or should have kind of feelings in your head that stick around.
So what happened next?
So we moved out of that camp very quietly. We didn't have a lot to say to each other, I think, because we didn't really know what to say. So we had a very awkward day and a half, maybe. We went up to the next area above treeline, next to another small lake. We set up camp. We tried to have some lessons and things, tried to sort of move on as if nothing had happened, but it wasn't going to work that way. One of the trainers recognized that, and he sort of put a pause to everything, and he said, okay, we need to do something about this. We need to talk about this. We need to work through it because it took a toll on us. So we talked about how we felt about that situation, how we felt now, whether we felt okay moving on. And then at the end of that conversation, he had us all find a rock. And everyone roamed around and we found a rock. And he told us to take all of the emotional feelings, all of the sadness and the feelings of guilt and feelings of powerlessness, and sort of concentrate them into this rock, and then walk to the edge of the lake when we're ready and chuck it in the lake and get rid of it.
What happened on the rest of the trip?
After that moment, the trip went pretty well, pretty smoothly.
On the last day, Greg's group finished dinner, packed up, and they headed back to the trailhead in the gathering darkness.
By the time we passed the lake that we knew that that guy was in, it was completely dark. And there was enough moonlight that we could walk by the light of the moon and the light of the stars. And we walked by that super eerie lake, knowing that there was a good chance that he was still in there. We figured the chances of a regular team getting him out was small, that a helicopter was probably needed to survey it, and we hadn't heard rotor blades, so we kind of assumed.
What did you feel when you were walking around that lake? Like, what was going through your head?
When you're in the mountains in really high, dangerous places, you have these feelings that that you're insignificant, that the mountains don't care about you. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about it, is that that's what I love the most about being in high, scary, amazing places, is that they're ambivalent. It's not that they want to hurt you, it's that they don't care. And I think being in that situation, walking around that lake, makes you feel that in such a deep way, that the place is so powerful and it can take things away from you in an instant. Several of us in that group stayed relatively close. I think it cemented a bond between many of us, and we held on to it pretty well. I remember there was a time when I was sitting next to somebody else who was on that same trip, and we were both on a couch watching some people play ping pong, and there was this moment between us where he kind of mentioned it, and I kind of responded, and we had this moment of recognition where we don't really need to talk about it right now. We'll just leave it. We'll leave it as it is and let it be what it is.
Did you ever find out what happened to the woman?
I don't know what happened to her. Like, I wish that I did, actually. I would love to know how that feels now and what her perspective of that situation was, but I don't know.
Do you ever think about her?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Especially when I'm in that area or just the mountains of Colorado. I wonder where she is and how she's doing and whether she got the kind of support that she needs. because I really don't know.
Storyteller was outdoor educator Greg Lay.
You're listening to Human Nature, and you can find us online at humannaturepodcast.org. Coming up, we'll hear from a man who traveled by boat from Montana all the way to Missouri, only it was his first time canoeing. From Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature. I'm Micah Schweitzer.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Here's a story about a man who takes a trip, but he wasn't very well prepared.
And she looked at me and said, "You're doomed."
Maybe so, but Patrick Dobson was already feeling a bit doomed, or at least stuck in his life in Kansas City.
You see, he had a young daughter, but he lived alone. His relationships weren't working out. And he was working a dead-end job.
It was in this state of distraction as I was painting this floor that I suddenly looked up and realized that I'd painted myself into the middle of the floor, just like in an old Max Sennett movie. a real sort of cliche kind of thing, but it happened, and I really felt a sense of despair at that moment.
That's when Patrick knew something had to change. So he decided to take a long walk to figure things out.
When I decided to walk to Montana, I let out the news very slowly. And when I decided to tell my daughter's mom, my daughter's brother's sitting there. He's not my son, but he's her brother. He was in sixth grade, and they were studying the Lewis and Clark expedition. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, if you're going to be all the way in Montana, why don't you canoe back on the Missouri River?" And I was like, "No, that's not going to happen."
But when he got up the next morning, he changed his mind. So he sent out some letters looking for a donated canoe, and he got lucky.
Bear Creek Canoes in Limerick, Maine, called and said he was laying up a new boat and wanted to know how it worked in the water. And he shipped it to Helena, Montana for me. He sent a life jacket and $40 for me to buy paddles. I had never been in a canoe before, except for one drunken weekend about 10 years before. And when I walked off my porch on May 1st, 1995, I was walking into a world that I really wasn't prepared for.
But between his porch and Helena, Patrick had to walk 1,300 miles.
By the time I got to Helena, I realized that I hadn't really let myself think about the river trip at all. And I was really scared. I had no idea on how to canoe the river. I had no idea how I was going to get my boat from Helena to Kansas City. When I was in Helena, I went to the sporting goods store that took delivery of my canoe. The boat was 16 feet long. It had very shallow draft, and it was purple. It was grape purple. And the guys in Helena, Montana at the sporting goods shop said that they'd never seen a canoe that was so ridiculously colored as that one. Now, I didn't think it was ridiculous. I thought it was cool because it was my boat. And I asked him, I said, "Can I get a canoe lesson? Is there somebody I can get a canoe lesson from?" And they recommended me to this guy who was, they said, well known in Montana for his whitewater canoeing skills. So we went to a pond in Helena City Park and put my boat in, and he, for the next hour, yelled at me while I zigzagged across the lake, and he tried to show me how to do a J stroke, and I couldn't get it right, and he would yell at me that, you know, he can't understand how come I couldn't get the J stroke right, and he told me to sweep, and I swept and turned the boat over. And he told me to pry, and I pried and turned the boat over again. So after this really humiliating hour, we got the boat back on the truck, and I tried to give him $20, and he just said, "No, man, forget it. I just consider this saving your life." And and then I asked him, "Have you ever been on the Missouri River?" He said, "Oh, no, I'd never go out there. It's too dangerous."
Patrick was almost ready to start his trip. He sat on a bench next to the river, working up the courage to get into his boat.
A group of trucks drives down into the boat access, and they're carrying trailers with Mackenzie drift boats on them. And the workers start unloading these boats and getting them in the water, and there's a bunch of dudes standing around, and dudes in the real sense of the word. These were all city guys who had their latest Orvis fly fishing gear on. And the woman who was in charge of the whole thing, after everybody got in the water and was away, came over and sat down on my bench with me and asked me what I was doing there. And I told her that I'd walked all the way from Kansas City and that I was going to canoe back to Kansas City on the river. And she looked at my gear and just basically said, "You don't know what you're doing, do you?" And I said, "I did so." And she looked at me and said, "You're doomed." I took off the next morning, and I barely knew how to maneuver my boat. But because of the current, the river really took me where it wanted me to go. And that first day was very successful. I mean, at least I thought. About halfway through the day, I began to think, "Hey, I can really do this. I know how to make my boat go from one side of the river to the other." And I really began to gain confidence. And about halfway through the day, I find myself sort of getting comfortable, laying back in the boat, reading, and then dozing off. And I got to sleep pretty heavily. And suddenly the boat reared up, and I literally came to, grabbed my paddle, and I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm. And heavy winds, and the water's being pushed back upstream in these big waves, and the lightning begins, and then the hail begins. I can't figure out whether I'm supposed to take shelter under the cut bank or over on the lee bank. And the lee bank has these big cottonwoods and these willow trees. And it had gotten dark, and I finally just let the wind and the river and my paddling take me into the willows under those cottonwoods, and pulled a little towel out of my backpack and put it over my head and shoulders as a shelter against the hail, which had gotten to be marble-sized by this time, and very, very painful kind of stuff. I've seen cottonwoods break up in heavy storms, and sure enough, a branch off one of those cottonwoods breaks and lands about a foot away from the canoe. And it wasn't just a branch or, you know, a twig. I mean, this was telephone pole-size branch. Hail begins to let up, and then the rain begins to let up, and I come out of my ball, and it just is a feeling of relief, relaxing all those muscles and realizing that I was still alive. I get back into the stream, and as soon as I round a corner, not 200 yards away from where I was stuck in the storm, was the place I wanted to camp that night. And I erupted into just hilarity, because here I was thinking that I was going to lose my life, and I was so far away from everything, and then right around the corner was the town of Ulm. Ome, Montana.
In Ome, Patrick met a couple, Jim and Diane. They were members of a local canoe club and offered to drive him around a dam.
And Diane began to ask me questions about how I stowed my stuff in the boat. And finally, she asked me where I was sitting in the boat. And I said, well, in the back of the boat. And she patted me on the shoulder. And she said, Patrick, when you're by yourself in the boat, you turn your boat around because the front seat is farther from the front than the back seat is from the back, which puts you in the middle of the boat, which distributes the weight easier and allows you more control of the canoe. And that one piece of advice made the rest of the trip a whole lot more enjoyable and much more comfortable. They took me the next day to Fort Benton, and I overnighted there, and then took off the next day into the Upper Missouri Wild and Scenic River. And of course, the Upper Missouri Wild and Scenic is starkly beautiful and a place where I was more alone than any other time in my life. There's no filters. There's nothing that stands in the way of me looking inside myself. I began to think about things like being a father and how I could be a better worker. And I really began to get to know myself probably in ways that I'd never done before because I'd never been so alone. And so on the Upper Missouri Wild and Scenic, I really had these moments of incredible contemplation about my life at home and who I was becoming.
Patrick's view of the river was changing too.
When I put the canoe in the river, I still had my childhood notions of the river in my head. I'd only known the river through stories, and most of them bad stories. Somebody got run over by a barge, a boat sank, anglers died, people drowned, it was polluted, it flooded, it did all kinds of nasty things, that it was big and that it was dangerous, and that it would somehow claim me if I let it. In some way, I had to fight it. I found out very quickly that I didn't need to fight the river. As a matter of fact, when I fought the river, that's when I had the most difficulties. The river over time became, it's very difficult to say the river became a friend because the river is a river, but the river took on a life of its own, and I began to know it in its nuances.
But then the river began to look different. In the Great Plains, the Missouri River is 700 miles of dammed reservoirs, more like lakes than a river. No current, plenty of wind.
And I had heard these terrible stories about, you know, people on these lakes and how they couldn't get across and how they'd become windbound and all of that. Well, my first day in the lake, I made 24 miles. And I thought, well, I've got this thing licked. This is an incredible experience. All this stuff about the lakes must be untrue. And so I'm having a great time, and I almost start a forest fire accidentally. And and the next day I get up, and that's when the winds began. And I made it about a mile that next day. And I spent the next 3 or 4 days paddling for hours to make 100 yards, 200 yards. As a matter of fact, at the end of 5 days, I decided I was going to go back to my campsite to get a pocket knife that I'd left there. And it took me a half an hour to walk back to my campsite that I was at 5 days before. And I thought, you know, that it would just be easier to put the boat on my shoulders and walk. But I decided one day that I would get up and paddle in the dark, which was one of the things that really scared me. That day, I did my first open water crossing, so you can't go down the shores of the lake or else you'd be going really hundreds and hundreds of miles. So you have to make these long open water crossings between the arms of the lake. And that was harrowing because then once I got out from the shore, I was in full barrel wind and I was cursing, and I even cursed the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt because under his administration this lake was built.
hundreds of miles of FDR's reservoirs were still ahead of Patrick. That's when he decided the only way he could finish the trip was to bypass all those reservoirs.
I had to realize my limitations and really allow the trip to become the thing it was on its own rather than something I thought it was supposed to be.
So Patrick found a man in Williston, North Dakota, willing to drive him the 650 miles to Yankton, South Dakota.
When I took off from Yankton, I was back into a part of the river that I was familiar with. There were lots of human-made sounds, railroads, cars, industries, those kinds of things. And it really took a couple of days of getting used to after having been on the upper Missouri and having it been so quiet with only natural sounds, with only sounds of animals. But I kind of relished it. I really did kind of like this mix of human and nature together, because even though those sounds were all around me, the way that the river works made me feel as if I could have been 1,000 miles away from them at the same time. After all, nobody's looking for you on the river. No one knows you're out there. And so I had this feeling of being close into society, yet very, very distant from it. And by this time, I also have this feeling that I want to go home. You know, I want to go home and I want to be with my kid, but I don't want to go home because that means getting a job. And that means perhaps getting back into the same sorts of routines and the same kinds of frustrations that I had before, and it also meant leaving what was really becoming this perfect life on the river, where I could sleep when I wanted to sleep, I could paddle when I wanted to paddle, I could do whatever I want, and with nobody there to tell me anything about it. And I had this feeling of really wanting the river to be longer. You know, if it's somehow it could stretch itself out by itself so that I wouldn't get to Kansas City.
In Omaha, Patrick met another man who was on a similar trip, except this man was not having a good time. So Patrick suggested they float together for the last leg of the trip.
I almost always just say it was 2 weeks of perfect life. We did whatever we wanted to do. If we got to a sandbar we liked, we stayed 2 nights. I mean, it doesn't take 2 weeks to get to Kansas City from Omaha in a canoe. But we took every bit of 2 weeks to get there. We didn't put on our shoes except to go into town to buy peanut butter. We swam when we wanted to swim. We fished when we wanted to fish. We shot guns when we wanted to shoot guns. It was really the perfect life. And when I arrived in Kansas City, I was excited to see my daughter, but very disappointed that the trip had ended.
What was it like to step out of the canoe for the last time?
It felt in a way that I was saying goodbye to an old friend. In some ways, I had formed that boat to me, but more importantly, that boat had formed me to it, so that I had become familiar with it, and it fit me like a glove. I had become comfortable with myself on this trip. I'd learned a lot about myself at the very end. All of my fears that I'd sort of stacked up over the river were largely unfounded. The river, I had a feeling, would always be there for me. It would always be there when I wanted to return. I almost felt like I needed to start on another trip almost immediately.
Did you ever learn the J stroke?
No, I still don't know how to do a J stroke. I wind up paddling on both sides of the boat, and it gets me where I'm going just fine.
Our storyteller was Patrick Dobson. You can read more about his adventure in his book, Canoeing the Great Plains.
By the way, Patrick is now married and has adopted a son. He plans on floating a large section of the Missouri River with his son in the summer.
It's Human Nature. You can also find us online at humannaturepodcast.org. Up next, how fly fishing helped heal a breast cancer survivor.
I'm Micah Schweitzer, and you're listening to Human Nature from Wyoming Public Media, real stories about where humans and our habitat meet.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. We'll end the show with the story of a woman with a secret.
I remember telling Hallie Jackson, the reporter at NBC News, that I was going to have to tell my brother now. And she said, "Your brother didn't know?"
Tanya Hansen still remembers the day she was diagnosed with breast cancer in vivid detail.
It was October 2nd. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I'd had a mammogram before that and then some needle biopsies that are just absolutely awful. And went in to see the gynecologist, and he said, "It's breast cancer." And I just burst into tears. And then the power went out. So we sat there in the dark, and he said, "You're going to have to come back in a couple hours because they've split a main line." So then I drove around for a couple of hours, wasting time until I could go back and talk more about cancer and what my options were. It was awful. It was the worst day of my entire life. Once you get a cancer diagnosis, you feel like you have an invader in your body. I felt a betrayal. You know, why me? Why did my body attack me? And then I was terrified as well, because all the time I had the notion, if anybody finds out I have cancer, I'm an attorney, and so it's a very small world, and I didn't want clients to think I was going to be dying and I'd lose all my business. So I couldn't tell anybody. And I was afraid of people that I did tell, if they would tell anybody. It was an incredibly lonely time in my life.
About a month after her diagnosis, Tanya had surgery. She drove from her home in a small town in Wyoming to a cancer center in Billings, Montana.
November 8th, I had double mastectomy, both breasts removed, and then immediate reconstruction. Making the decision to remove was easy. The after effects, though, the scarring, the scars hurt. Every now and then, they'll just hurt. So every day, it's a reminder of cancer, because the scarring is pretty significant.
All the while, Tanya wasn't letting on that she was sick. When she had her surgery, she only took a week off of work. Most people wouldn't have even known anything was wrong.
So who did you tell that you had cancer?
My very first phone call was to my significant other. And then my next phone call was to my daughter. And I couldn't call my mom because it was her birthday. So we had her birthday weekend, and then I told her. So those were the first three people, but I said, "You can't tell anybody else." I have a client that is a dear, dear friend, and I told him because he knew something was a little off with me. And then I told my law partner, and that was it.
Wow.
Yeah, five people.
And those were the only five for a year and a half?
Yes. Wow. Yes. I did a good job keeping a secret. Lawyers can keep secrets.
And then a few months after her surgery, Tanya went to a picnic for cancer survivors at the hospital in Billings.
And they had a booth, and there was Casting for Recovery booth, and it's fly fishing for breast cancer survivors.
Tanya thought a retreat in Montana would be perfect because no one from Wyoming would be there and her secret would still be safe. So she applied to Casting for Recovery in Montana.
And I got an email that said, you can't come to the Montana retreat, you have to go to Wyoming. And I remember thinking, no, because there'll be Wyoming people there and maybe then somebody will find out. But I went ahead and applied to Wyoming. I found out I got accepted. I was so excited.
So on a summer day, Tanya packed up her bags and headed to a ranch at the base of the Wind River Mountains.
It's in the most beautiful area. Absolutely fantastic. I was driving up a dirt road. It was literally probably 10 miles off of the main road. Beautiful mountains, cows grazing in the pastures, blue skies the entire time. We had rain one evening. It was just nature at its supreme being.
Had you ever fly fished before?
I had not, and I'm hooked. I'm absolutely hooked. It's very mind-consuming. I call it my new meditation therapy. There's absolutely nothing else to think about except fly fishing.
What was it like to learn?
Fly fishing's hard. I did not realize it's so technical. You have to know what the fish are eating. So you have to know about bugs and the life cycle of bugs. You have to know how to tie knots. And then we went out into a yard and actually practiced casting with a piece of yarn at the end of our line, because it's all very, very technical and it's all about timing. So if you go too far, your line's gonna end up in the weeds behind you. If you use your wrist instead of your whole arm, your line's just going to wrinkle up in front of you. So in order to get that fly that weighs nothing into the water, you have to do absolutely everything right.
Can you tell me about your first fish?
My first fish on a fly. So when I got to Du Bois, I had lunch, and then I went to a fly fishing shop. And I walked in and I said, I want to buy a fly. I want a commemorative fly. I've never fly fished. I'm going to do my first cast with the first fly I ever buy. So when we went out fishing, the guide tied on my fly and she says, we're going to walk over here to this little spot because I think we'll catch a fish over here. And then right over next to the shore, she says, see if you can get your fly over there. And instantly one nabbed. And I jerked too fast, and I lost it. But the next time, I caught it, and I kissed my first fish. It was the most spectacular 2.5 days I have spent in a really, really long time. It was a remarkable experience, because nobody was asking the cancer questions. We didn't talk about cancer. It was a cancer retreat where nobody talked about cancer.
Nobody talked about cancer, except for NBC News.
About a week before we got there, we had information that potentially NBC News was going to show up to do a report. I was like, okay, no big deal. NBC News is not coming to Wyoming. I show up at the retreat and the director says, oh, by the way, NBC News is going to be here and we'd like you to be interviewed. I went, oh, crumb. If this airs, everybody's going to find out.
This morning, we head out west where some women are learning a new skill, fly fishing.
Yeah, NBC's Hallett Jackson explains how catching a fish and letting it go is helping these women heal.
On Wyoming's Wind River, it's tough to find trout today. Not that Tanya Hansen minds.
And I remember telling Holly Jackson, the reporter at NBC News, that I was going to have to tell my brother now. And she said, your brother didn't know? I said, I couldn't tell my brother because he might tell someone else.
After you told your secret to NBC, what changed?
I was nervous. I was scared. I was still scared what people would think. I was still fearful it would impact my business. And I was more afraid to come back and have to tell my brother and have to explain to my brother why he didn't know and why I didn't feel like I could tell him. So when I got back to town on Sunday afternoon, I called my brother and I said, we need to meet. He says, so what's up? And I said, well, I had breast cancer about a year and a half ago. And he said, what? And so I just kind of told him the story, and I told him why I didn't feel like I could share with people and what I was worried about. I said I couldn't tell people because I couldn't have people think that I was going to die.
How did you explain to him, your brother, that you couldn't tell him in particular?
I apologized to him and told him I was really sorry that he didn't know such an important topic in me. And I really did kind of feel ashamed that I didn't feel like I could tell him, because I think that he could have kept that as a secret. But again, nobody could know. Nobody could know. I could not take the chance on anybody in the community finding out.
How did you feel inside after that secret was out?
Honestly, I kind of feel free now. It feels good to not have a secret anymore.
So if it came back and you were practicing, would you make that same decision to keep it private?
No. This time I would be upfront with, I'm sick. I would reach out for help. I would reach out for prayers. Because it was a very lonely experience going through that by myself.
How often do you still fly fish?
I fish 3 to 4 times a week. Instead of staying at my office and finishing up that last project, at 5:30, I am out the door. I have my waders on, I have my vest on, and I'm headed to the water. There's a certain release that happens with you catching this living animal and then removing the fly without hurting him and letting him go back in the water. It's part of survival. They don't immediately just take off and go back to their life. Sometimes you have to, you know, kind of let them revive themselves and hold them in the water in order for them to go. So it's almost kind of a healing sensation to catch the fish, be exhilarated, and then say, okay, so go back to your life, and I know you're going to need a little help, so let me help you survive.
How did the Casting for Recovery experience and retreat, how did that change you?
It changed me on a deep spiritual level. I was not out in nature until I went to that Casting for Recovery retreat, and I got an appreciation for nature. When you look around and you've got grass growing and you've got trees surviving, you've got water flowing no matter what, we are part of that. And so when you can identify with nature, nothing seems impossible. I am more grateful for nature than I've ever been. Every morning I walk along Clear Creek, along a path. And I used to just walk. I used to just be full of my thoughts and full of everything. Now I walk along that creek and I look for fish. I look to see if the water levels are down. I look to see if water levels are up. I no longer look at water as just being the creek that flows through town. It's now... it's a part of me. It's a part of me.
Our storyteller was Tanya Hansen. Today, she's cancer-free.
You can hear more stories about human experiences in nature at our website, humannaturepodcast.org, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and send us comments and story ideas.
The show was produced by Aaron Jones and Ryan Oberhelman. Anna Rader is our digital producer.
The theme song is by Kata Ghost. I'm Micah Schweitzer.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Human Nature is a production of Wyoming Public Media. It's human nature.